You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2025, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And the recently not doing taxes, Evan Bernstein.
Oh, so this is what sunlight
yeah,
is
you
like,
forgot.
Right?
April 16th is one day after tax day, so now you get a little bit of a breather, right? I know you still have like other stuff to do, but...
Yeah, now we enter the second, right, the extensions. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because I become very immersed in the work. I mean, just the volume itself takes up all of my time. For example, I will get up and be out of the house at 7 in the morning every morning, if not earlier. And in these later days leading up to April 15th, I'd be getting home at 2 in the morning. I kid you not. Going right to sleep and then waking up and doing it again. And that's really how my last couple of weeks of the season was this year. So there is really not much else. It's amazing I've actually made the podcast as often as I had, because that's the only other thing I've been able to kind of squeeze in here. Haven't been doing Which Game First. I had to put that to the side for a little while. But I'm just coming out of the space now, and it does take a little while to adjust. It's quite a feeling.
Yeah, it's hard maintaining a day job and doing the skeptical thing.
Just, you know, this seasonal work can be brutal. Yeah. It can be. But I'm glad it's over, and very happy for April 16, one of my favorite days of the year.
And Kara, you are in Hong Kong now.
Yeah, I'm still in Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong last week, and now I'm in Hong Kong until Monday, and then I'm going to mainland China, and then I'm going to Vietnam. After that, so
have you been to Vietnam before?
No, Vietnam will be new. I've been to Hong Kong and mainland China. I was here 7 years ago, actually, with some of the skeptic organizations out here, doing some events, some skeptics in the pub, you know, getting to know people, and I made some kind of lifelong friends. So now I'm back, but it's been great. My friends are so kind. They've like taken off of work to hang out with me and show me the sights. Been doing a lot of big hikes, going to really beautiful beaches, kind of exploring the natural side of Hong Kong. So it's very cool, that juxtaposition between the intense, intense city, amazing food, really kind people, lots to do.
Kara, we talk every now and then about the SGU going out to either Hong Kong or Japan or just somewhere in Asia. But it's hard to get a read on how big like the skeptical movement is out there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What's your experience with that?
You know, when I was here last time, it was strong and mighty, but small. But it's hard to know, especially because, you know, how many people listen to SGU but wouldn't consider themselves part of some sort of movement where they're going to skeptical meetups, for example, but they like the podcast and they would want to come see the show. Obviously, Hong Kong is a massive melting pot and it's got a huge expat community as well. There's a very large English-speaking portion of the region. And I think we could say the same thing for a lot of places throughout the world. Like, I think about the European skeptics. I think about the upcoming eclipse, you know, places where we could travel to. Because it does seem to be the case that we've done most of our shows domestically in the U.S. Or where do we go typically?
UK, Australia.
English-speaking countries.
But not even
primarily
all.
Primarily English.
Yeah, but not even all of them. Really just UK
Canada.
And Australia and Canada. Yeah. But what about South Africa?
They speak Canadian.
What about other parts of Europe, you know?
There was like one time where somebody from the South African skeptics contacted me and said, hey, can we bring the SGU down here? We could get 20 people to show up to a meeting. And we're like,
yeah. That's the issue, right?
Yeah, that's the issue.
We need to know that we can get it. What are we looking at? 200, 300, 500?
Oh, hundreds. Yeah. It should be hundreds.
Yeah.
I mean, to get us to travel internationally, we'd like to see 200 to 300 people show up at our event.
At least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
that makes it
way too expensive. Yeah. But again, but I agree with you. Like, probably like a skeptics in the pub may not be the full measure of who we would get to show up at an event.
And I think what folks might not realize is it's not just the five of us. It's also Ian. It's also all of the logistics that are involved in it. And
George.
And George, of course, and maybe Brian or, you know, anybody else who might be involved. But most of us do have jobs. And so the thing that we have to realize, too, is that when we do an event like that, and it's one thing to go like, oh, we're going on vacation. We can't take weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks off every single year. We have to be really strategic about how we travel. And it's also work for us.
Right. I used almost all of my vacation time over the last 15 years, at least, on SGU events.
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Same
Very
here.
Few, like, just straight up vacations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Two or three events a year. That's it. That eats up all of our vacation time. Yeah. And that's really, really hard if we are also paying out of pocket to travel. Mm-hmm. And it just gets very expensive. So that's the hardest part of all of this, is figuring out how to make it financially feasible, because it's something we'd love to do.
Yeah, no, we love traveling and meeting our listeners from around the world. We love holding events. It's great. But yeah, but we're kind of like right on that edge in terms of it being financially feasible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you do want us to come to your part of the world, having said all that, you know, then talk to us. But we also need to know that, you know, there's enough people are going to want to come out and see us.
For sure.
All right. Well, let's get started with the news items. Actually, Evan, you're going to start us off with the dumbest thing of the week.
I am going to. And for the sake of brevity, I'll spare everyone the song this time and I'll break it out
next time.
I'm going to put one or more of you on the spot, though, with a question to start this one. Kara, name a story or a TV show or a movie or some other medium of fiction where a person was turned to stone.
You pick the person who doesn't watch fantasy. Wait, Medusa? Did Medusa turn people to stone?
There you go. Yeah, bingo. Medusa. Thank you. Very good. Medusa. Yeah, yes. Okay. Perseus and Medusa would look at people and turn them to stone.
There you go.
Very good.
Okay.
And Bob, do you have one?
She took mine. I was going to say Sodom and Gomorrah, but that's a pillar of salt. That's not stone.
Yes, you can. Yeah. I will accept that, though, because salt is sort of a foreign mineral. Very good. Jay or Steve, you want to
mention one? Well, I did Gargoyles.
Yes, but which
cartoon series?
Is it called Gargoyles? Yeah.
Cartoon series.
Well, they're the Gargoyles turned into stone.
I could back Steve up on that. He's right.
Very cool. Very cool.
Evan, I think somebody turned to stone in the original Star Trek series.
Oh, right. Or the
Kelvins?
The mineral cubes, you mean?
Somebody turned to stone.
Yeah, the D20. They turned into like a salty D20.
Dodecahedron, I believe.
Right.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, look, you can – and those are great examples. And I think we can all agree that people or live creatures being turned to stone is 100% pure fantasy. It is fiction. It is 100% implausible, a physical impossibility. No connection to reality whatsoever. But you are all incorrect, because once again, thanks to the recent declassification and release to the public of all sorts of government information that was once kept secret by United States' agencies, our clandestine services, we not only have things like psychics looking for Arks of the Covenant, like I talked about 2 weeks ago, but we now know that the ability to turn living things into stone almost instantaneously is a fact. And not only is it a fact, but it's a power not of this world, because extraterrestrial beings and their amazing technology have the capability of turning people to stone.
I did not
thanks
know this.
All to it. Yep. Thanks all to a declassified CIA report brought to light, in which there was one such incident reported where Russian soldiers in the 1980s fought off a UFO and got turned to stone by the aliens that they were fighting.
What?
Joe Rogan. Yeah, no. Joe Rogan told us. He shared the details of this 250-page report. Yep, that was allegedly written by the CIA.
Allegedly.
The original report was apparently provided initially, the source of it, KGB agents, late 1980s, and later covered by Ukrainian media. And the incident was also documented in a classified intelligence file in 1993, according to the Jerusalem Post. But obviously, it has become brought to light again because of all the declassification that's been recently going on. I'll read you a couple of highlights directly from the report so you can hear it yourself. According to the KGB, this is the report. According to the KGB materials, a quite low-flying spaceship in the shape of a saucer appeared above a military unit that was conducting routine training maneuvers. For unknown reasons, somebody unexpectedly launched a surface-to-air missile and hit the UFO. It fell to Earth not far away, and five short humanoids with large heads and large black eyes emerged from it. It's stated in the testimonies by the two soldiers who remained alive that after freeing themselves from the debris, the aliens came close together and then merged into a single object that acquired a spherical shape. That object began to buzz and hiss sharply and then became brilliant white. In a few seconds, the spheres grew much bigger and exploded by flaring up with an extremely bright light. At that instant, 23 soldiers who had watched the phenomenon turned to stone. Only two soldiers in the shade were less exposed and they survived.
What?
Okay. You're right. And then it goes on. First of all, a couple points here. First of all, Joe Rogan. All right. Second of all, second point, Soviet KGB. And third point, perhaps most important, a report that said something happened, therefore it is true. This reads like a children's book at best, and it's not even that good of a children's book, frankly. All you have to do is go to prior works of fiction, and, you know, forgive me, I'm not attacking religion here, but the Bible, for example, is filled to the brim with stories about metamorphosis, polymorphing, and Bob's favorite, transmogrification.
Ooh.
Of course. You know, you mentioned Lot's wife, Pillar of Salt, turned it, but there are so many examples of things like this. And look, throughout history, these kinds of stories have been told. And, but here's what Joe Rogan said. Because I listened to this section of his podcast. He said, it's really interesting what's going on with these disclosures, and it's hard to know what's true and what's not true. No, Joe Rogan, it's actually not hard at all. And then he goes on to reference like the FLIR video and the Go Fast video. These are those UFO videos from captured by the pilots, the Navy pilots, as the best evidence of inexplicable UFO events. And of course, those have been pretty thoroughly debunked by Mick West and others. So there you go. You have the Joe Rogan crowd, the UFO UAP crowd, all going, yep, this is real because of a made-up Soviet-era throwback and what was likely deliberately fabricated nonsense that wound up eventually in a CIA report. And there you have it. That is your dumbest thing of the week.
Ugh.
How bad is that?
They reported it on Fox News.
That's pretty bad.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Jay, where did Earth's water come from?
Well, before we get into that, Steve.
The faucet.
Now, guys, I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to be honest. Do you drink enough water?
I try to.
Who gets to determine what enough is?
I will determine that.
I don't drink 8 8-ounce glasses.
Oh, that's BS.
That's a myth, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Since that was a hard question, I don't know if you guys are even going to be able to come close to answering this one, but do you know where the Earth's water came from, or at least what the current theories are?
Comets is one.
Yes, comets delivered them in the early, proto-Earth? During the bombardment, heavy bombardment?
Yeah, there's four common theories that you'll hear. You know, that one of them, comets, like icy comets that bombarded the Earth. This was about 4 billion years ago. Solar nebula capture, right? Hydrogen from the solar nebula was captured by the early Earth, and that combined with oxygen to form water, and then asteroids. Scientists have theorized that, you know, water-rich asteroids collided with the early Earth, and, you know, that's where a lot of water came from. Now, the one I always thought it was the concept of outgassing from Earth's interior.
Yeah.
And I think I got this from going to Walt Disney World when we were a lot younger, and I watched some video, and it stuck with me.
Oh, yeah. It's a wet world after all.
But there has been some new research that may very well change what scientists around the world think the real source of water was. So, like I was saying, you know, for many decades, scientists thought that the water that simply just wasn't there when our planet formed, right? The belief was that water was, like you said, guys, was delivered by water-rich asteroids or comets during like the first 100 to 200 million years after the Earth formed. And, you know, that made sense. It does make sense. It's kind of like a happy happenstance, right? It wasn't like a planned thing, of course. Like, you know, these asteroids or comets had to, had to hit the Earth in order for the Earth to have water, going under that theory. But the early solar system was dry and it was violent, right? It was very hot. It was not a nice place to be. And this was particularly true in the inner region where the Earth took shape, you know, the inner planets. And the minerals making up Earth's early building blocks appeared to be bone dry after, you know, doing the best research that we can on anything that we can find that would shed some light on what it was like back then. So the prevailing equation for our oceans was that their water came from collisions with icy comets and water-rich asteroids that came from the outer solar system. But there's a big but. So there's a new study published in the journal Icarus, and it came to a different conclusion, and it's really compelling. The study was led by a research team at the University of Oxford, and the study focused on a mineral. It's called enstatite chondrites. Have you guys heard of this?
Heard of chondrites.
Chondrites are in meteorites.
Yeah, chondrites.
Yeah. So this is a particular, it's a silicate mineral. And the research focused on a meteorite called LAR12252. Again, why don't they give them cooler names? I don't know. So it, this meteorite was chemically similar to the material that built Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. They used a really powerful technique called sulfur X-ray absorption spectroscopy. Kara?
Spectroscopy.
Thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And,
I get that wrong too, Jay.
I'm not
that
even, you know,
like, twists me.
You know, if you watch the live stream last Wednesday, but today's Wednesday and I'm sick and my mouth is not getting around words right now.
That's fair. That one's tough too, because mix it up with spectrometer, spectroscopy. Yeah, it's all.
They examined using this new machine. They were able to examine on a microscopic level what is actually going on in this mineral. So what they found was very surprising to the researchers. The meteorite contained a large amount of hydrogen, and it wasn't from Earth's contamination. The hydrogen was chemically bonded to sulfur, meaning it was part of the meteorite's original composition. Why is this significant? Well, this directly challenges the longstanding assumption that that mineral, enstatite chondrite, right, or a Klondike bar, right? So this discovery directly challenges the longstanding assumption that the mineral was too dry to supply any hydrogen and therefore water to the early Earth. So past studies have only found tiny amounts of hydrogen in these rocks, but they hadn't looked in the right places or in the right form. And that's a mind bender right there. They looked for hydrogen. They didn't find it. But with this new tool, they found it. The new research shows that most of the hydrogen is stored as hydrogen sulfide. And this is in the meteorite's fine-grained matrix, which is a part of the rock that has completely been ignored. That region turned out to contain almost 10 times more hydrogen than other parts of the meteorite. So the implications of this are astounding. Earth's primary building material, which is that mineral, contained, you know, they had no idea that it contained that much hydrogen from the start, and it dramatically changes our understanding of the origins of Earth's water, or potentially where the origin was from. So in this model, water isn't it is not like a galactic lucky afterthought. It was a predictable outcome of the materials and the conditions at the time our planet formed, which is huge. That's a really impressive find that they did, and it's a game changer. And the study also offers a likely explanation for how the hydrogen got into the rock in the first place. The researchers found that areas rich in hydrogen were also full of pyrrhotite, which is a mineral made of iron and sulfur. These grains probably formed when hydrogen gas from the early solar system reacted with iron sulfide in a cloud of sulfur-rich dust. That reaction created hydrogen sulfide, and that's a gas, which then mixed into nearby molten rock. As the molten material cooled quickly into glass, right? That's what they're calling it. The hydrogen was sealed inside. So in other words, the hydrogen became part of the rock when it first formed. It wasn't added later by any outside sources.
Yeah. And these chondrites, right? When we think about chondrites, do you guys collect meteorites at all?
Yeah.
Anybody? Yeah.
I wish.
No, never,
so I have like a bowl
them,
of them.
You do?
Yeah. Chondrites are the non-metallic, like non-
like nodules, right?
Non-ferrous.
Yeah. Yeah. They're the ones that look non-ferrous. Like rocks that are kind of variegated, because the way that they formed was in the early solar system, right? They were primitive asteroids, and they have all these little speckles on them, because the idea is that all that dust and those little grains all like coalesced, and they haven't changed since then.
Yep.
Like they're cool. Neat. Like these are billions of years old.
You have them?
Yeah, of course.
What do you mean, of course? Not everybody has
You don't
has
collect
these?
Oh.
Yeah.
I assume Steve had a little collection too. Maybe not.
Yeah, Steve.
I have a couple that I bought. I don't have any that I found.
I've been given a couple, but.
Yeah, yeah.
So this process, Kara, it would have occurred in the inner solar system. Mm-hmm. And again, like I was saying, it was hot. It was a sulfur-rich environment. And this is where Earth and probably Mars and Venus formed. And if that's the case, then it's not just Earth that could have started out wet. The mechanism, you know, they're saying it could apply to any planet that formed from similar material under similar conditions, which are largely the inner planets. And the significance of this work lies in what it removes from the equation, which is chance. Remember I was saying, like, you know, we're just lucky that these water-rich comets and asteroids came to Earth. You know, it's nothing. The asteroid delivery hypothesis depends on a series of you know, super low probability events. But if the hydrogen, and, you know, of course, when I'm saying that, by extension, I also mean water. If that was inherent to Earth's formation, then the presence of oceans becomes much, much less surprising. And water and the potential for it to, you know, create life and everything may be a default condition for rocky planets that are formed in these right zones and not by some crazy, cosmic accident that is the previous prevailing theory. So I think that is, it's pretty profound. You know, of course, there's going to be other studies and they're going to, you know, further try to find more evidence and try to see if this holds up to scrutiny. But the bottom line is it was a major, major find, major significant perspective on where water likely came from.
Yeah. Of course, this doesn't mean that there weren't comets or, you know, later meteorites that brought more water to the Earth, but it's just a matter of where the bulk of it came from.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Sure. I mean, you know, one theory, Steve, is that it's all of these things.
It's all of these things. Yeah. It's all about a proportion.
You know, what I wanted to find out, and I could not find anything, and I went to the original study, was how much could they have calculated? Like, it seems that they're implying that there would have been enough hydrogen to make this amount of water that's on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't confirm or deny that, but I think that's pretty implied in the study.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Kara.
Yeah.
So tell me, how much emissions is the United States putting out every year? Like, of greenhouse
Nobody
gases?
Nobody knows, Steve. Nobody knows. How is one to know the answer to this question except by a federal regulation, Title 40, from the Environmental Protection Agency, especially Part 98, the GHGRP, which is, let me read right here.
Greenhouse.
Yep.
Something.
Good job. More? Any more? Greenhouse,
greenhouse gas
reporting program.
Ah.
Yeah. Super important. Codified by Congress that mm-hmm. required, about 8,000 facilities every year to report their emissions to the EPA, right? So we're talking a lot of data here. And specifically, emissions that are direct, so reported at the individual facility level, but also upstream suppliers. GHGRP did not include historically emissions from agriculture or lower emitting sources, like direct emissions that had annual emissions of less than 25,000 metric tons of CO2, or sinks of greenhouse gases. But any other, what would you call it? Like facility? I guess they use that term a lot. Any other individual facility or upstream facility that produced methane or other climate warming gases was required by law, has been required by law to report their annual emissions. And guess what's going to happen to that?
Going to go bye-bye.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Unfortunately, Trump has plans to stop collecting that greenhouse gas data. And we know this basically from some reporting by ProPublica, which has been reposted here in UnDark. Two of Trump's officials, Tardif and Szabo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. So political appointee Abigail Tardif, who is now the principal deputy assistant administrator of the EPA's Office of Air and Radiation, recently, as of I think just a couple days ago, about a week ago now, instructed EPA staff to draft up a rule that would eliminate reporting requirements for 40 of the 41 sectors of that federal regulation that are now required to submit that data. She has not made any further comment on that. And then another political appointee, Aaron Szabo, he is awaiting a confirmation as assistant administrator to the EPA. He also has been directed to effect change in this area. Neither of them have obviously responded to comment from reporters. Both Tardif and Szabo previously worked as lobbyists. Szabo represented the American Chemistry Council and Duke Energy and a bunch of different companies and trade groups. And Tardif worked for Marathon Petroleum and the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers Association. So these are two individuals basically now working with or at EPA, directing policy about emissions reporting, who previously were lobbyists for energy sector jobs. So let's talk about what this means. You know, we know that we have to design policy around what's happening to our climate. And it's very, very difficult to write policy if we don't have data, right? Like how do we affect change when it comes to climate emissions if we don't know what those climate emissions are? Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking, again, oil refineries, power plants, coal mines, petrochemical manufacturers, cement, glass, iron, steel manufacturers. And we're talking about carbon dioxide, methane, all these other different greenhouse gases. Yeah. Oh, not agriculture. Agriculture is not included in this.
Oh, not agriculture?
Not in this specific legislation.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So obviously not every bill can do everything. This specific legislation is not targeted towards agriculture, the greenhouse gas reporting program. Edward Maybach, who is a professor at George Mason University, said in response to this decision to obviously stop collecting all of this vital information, he said, quote, "It would be a bit like unplugging the equipment that monitors the vital signs of a patient that is critically ill. How in the world can we possibly manage this incredible threat to America's well-being and humanity's well-being if we're not actually monitoring what we're doing to exacerbate the problem?" Another important quote here is by Rachel Cletus, who is a senior policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She said, "The bottom line is this is a giveaway to emitters, just letting them off the hook entirely. Not tracking the data does not make the climate crisis any less real. This is just putting our heads in the sand." It's very disconcerting.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. We don't know where we're going to net out with this, obviously, because these policy changes are happening really, really fast and loose. They're happening very often through executive action and not through legislative action. And there's still a lot of questions. We are not legal scholars here on the SGU. I am definitely not a legal scholar. There's still a lot of question about whether the ordering and then the implementation of these policy changes, which were legislative policies, is even legal to do, right, at an executive level. So we don't know how this will net out, but we do know that we have already started to see some changes from within the agency. So like last month, they announced that they were reconsidering the program. EPA on March 12th sent out this kind of like suite of bulletins celebrated. They said that, quote, "It was the most consequential day of deregulation in U.S. history." You can read it right there on the EPA website where Administrator Zeldin talks about all these things that they call, quote, "historic actions to power the great American comeback." So they, you know, they bullet point them in there. Basically, the argument here is that this reporting program is burdensome and it costs American businesses and manufacturing, you know, millions of dollars. I love how they hide under that. Like, it hurts small businesses and the ability to achieve the American dream. We're talking about like the largest polluters across the country. It's 85 to 90% of all greenhouse gases which are reported by this program. 85 to 90%. And we're just not going to have access to that data. And the thing is, that's really devastating because the data itself helps these companies function. It helps American businesses. They don't have to do their own, you know, individual data collection and forecasting because they have access to federal data that's mandated that everybody can use unfettered because our tax dollars pay for it. But now that's, you know, not going to be the case. And here's another quote, which I think is an important one by Andrew Light. He was the Assistant Secretary of Energy for International Affairs during the Biden administration. He said, "We will not get to the kinds of temperature stabilization needed to protect Americans against the worst climate impacts unless we get the cooperation of developing countries. If the United States won't even measure and report our own emissions, how in the world can we expect China, India, Indonesia, and other major growing developing countries to do the same?" So we know that when Trump first took office, the portal where companies could share their data was closed by the Trump administration and stayed closed for several weeks. So already emissions reporting has been really, really delayed. And then, you know, through these series of bulletins, the fate of this program is not looking good. Even if these programs aren't shuttered, or if they are shuttered, let's say via executive action, but then brought back through legislative, I guess, saving, the damage is already done, right? That move fast and break things attitude actually gets what they want to get accomplished, even if later on it has to be reinstated, because when the data are lost, the data are lost.
It's just faster to tear things down than it is to build
way easier.
Up.
Exactly. And to make it harder to report and to close down a portal, and now you can't log in and now you can't do your job. So maybe even if everything gets back online in 6 months or hell, 4 years, you know, mm-hmm. who knows? What do we do about that massive hiccup where the whole machine, you know, ground to a halt?
Yeah. This seems to be a pattern though of, essentially, let's just stop collecting information, you know, or whatever.
In many and then maybe it won't be real.
Let's just not report information. They, mm-hmm. you know, like just, well, let's just not report COVID cases. This is like a pattern. This is not an isolated incident.
While we're at it, let's delete a lot of information too.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Well,
let's rewrite history.
No, absolutely. Yeah. This is like just control the information, limit it. Let's not research the effects of gun violence, you know, or the effectiveness of gun safety regulation. Let's just not study it. Let's just not collect the data. Let's just not report the data. The CDC, we're not going to report measles numbers anymore. Why alarm people? This is a very disturbing pattern, because they say, you know, information, facts, data is the beginning, right? This is a crucial thing that feeds into our ability to have science-based policy, science-based discussions.
100%.
That's the point. Yeah.
And it goes far beyond partisan politics. This regulation to report this climate data was a congressional regulation. This is law. This is clearly, there may have been people in the past, you know, on certain sides of the aisle who pushed back, but this passed. This is bipartisan policy, and it's held for quite some time. This new idea of just not getting any information goes far beyond partisan politics. It's heartbreaking to see so much hard work, so much collective strategy, so much science being just dismantled in front of our eyes.
Yeah. Well, if there's no objective information, then you can create whatever political narrative you wish. Mm-hmm. Right. And that substitutes for reality.
Exactly. But that has never, ever been the policy of the left or the right in this country. It's never been, let's just not have information and let's fill it with vacuum.
Not like this.
That's what's so heartbreaking. Yeah. Not like this. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. That's what's so heartbreaking.
Terrible. And again, I know we're trying awfully hard not to be like partisan or political on this show, but this is about data. This is about science. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
They're just trying to win the whole global warming thing by fiat, by just like, oh, we're just not going to track data. So, right? That's what it is.
And it's not specific even to global warming.
No,
that's
you're right.
The really scary thing.
Yeah.
This isn't political per se. I mean, it is political, but it's not partisan.
Yeah. It's not a typical left-right Yeah,
exactly.
Conservative liberal issue. This is a democracy issue, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, let's move on. So let me ask you guys a question. This is a totally late night college dorm room stoner type of question.
Okay, go ahead,
dude.
Is my red your red? Right.
Wow. I hate R-E-D, this question.
Not R-E-A-D. Yeah, we've talked about this.
I know. We have talked
there
about
is
that.
Well,
we did. Is this the blue dress?
No.
The gold dress?
No.
But there is a difference between subjective downstream interpretation, but no, that there are wavelengths of light that we all observe similarly because we have the same architecture. Whether you interpret red as having a specific feeling or it feels different to you, or I don't know, even like the way that you talk about red is different. But
how you perceive
But the red
it,
that you see is the same red that I see.
Yeah, but it's ultimately an unanswerable question because we're talking about a fully subjective experience, qualia.
Yeah. But I think we often forget that first half of it.
But we have deficits too, and that varies from person
to person.
That's
true. Yeah, but those are observable. Those are demonstrable. We understand exactly how those deficits work.
So there are certainly hardcore deficits like various types of color blindness that can be objectively determined. I have a red-green I think diffusion, you call it color blindness.
Yeah, it's red, green, or red, green, yellow. Like, there's very specific types.
Like, I can't see certain numbers in those little boxes of bubbles, you know, of circles. I just can't see the numbers.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't determine sometimes the difference between
But we're not
colors.
Talking about that. They're just talking about, is your experience of a color the same as, you know, or at least similar to? There's probably everyone will see, even I see different shades at different times, depending on conditions and whatever. You know, even if I'm sleep deprived, things might look a little bit different to me or whatever. But basically red always looks red, you know, to me, my subjective experience of it. And I have no way of knowing what your subjective experience of it is. But scientists are interested in that question and trying to figure out, is there any way that we can infer what the probable answer is? There's, you know, one way that we can argue it is to say, as you were saying, Kara, we all have the same brains. We have mammalian brains, we have human brains, and there's no reason to think that anyone's experience of something as fundamental as just color would be fundamentally different than anyone else's.
Yeah.
Also, another inference is, this is again not rock solid, but there's generally agreement about, like, yeah, blue is a common color and red is an exciting color. You know, like, there are certain emotions that go along with it, but you could argue that's completely learned and
association. Subjective experiences.
Association. All right. So this gets us to this study, where this is the approach that they took. And that's what I'm fascinated in, like, how they approached the question, not so much like the data that came out of it. But what they did was they created a network of color associations, right? That's the framework that they created. In other words, is this color, right, showing that somebody red without labels. So they didn't communicate in labels, just is this color more similar to this color over here or that color over there? So you would show them red, pink, and green. And somebody might say, yeah, the red is closer to the pink than it is to the green. And they just keep doing that to build up this network of associations.
Wait, red is closer to pink than green? Wait a second. Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, God, no, Bob.
You had me for a third of a
second.
Now,
what did they use as a control?
I don't know.
People who are colorblind. And they had them.
So it was a negative control. People can't tell the difference.
So they went through the same process. Well, again, there's different kinds of colorblind. It's not people just seeing in black and white. They just have.
No, it's red, green is the most common.
Yeah, so they have a limited color palette. So the question, the hypothesis was that if we see colors the same, then neurotypical people in terms of their color vision would all build the same network of color relationships, but people who are colorblind would build a different network of color relationships. Mm. Does that make sense? And that's what
reasonable.
They found.
Yeah.
That's what they found.
I like it.
So again, this is not ironclad, rock solid, but it is just like, this is what we would predict if this thing that we think is probably true were true. And that's what they found. So and that kind of makes sense, you know, that if we're seeing colors the same way, then we would think, yeah, lavender is more like purple than it is like green or whatever. Like you would make those associations would be the same as well, even when they're discrete frequencies, right? They are different frequencies. They are different mixtures of your cones, right? So you could, if people saw colors differently, you could experience completely different relationships among those colors too. You don't have to, but you could. So at least this is consistent with the conclusion that people see color the same way.
All right. That's encouraging.
Yeah,
that's
little wrinkle in this sort of old, again, kind of like college dorm room question.
It's a good idea, though. I like I like the way they approached it. Like you said, it was a cool idea.
Yeah. That was the point. All right. That was just a quick one for me this week.
Oh, boy. Holy crap.
Bob, tell us about the evolution of complex life.
You're done? I was just settling in. What? Yeah. You're
that
done?
Was it.
Jesus. Bob, I gotta
cede my time to you, Bob.
I yield my time.
Yeah, I might need it. Okay. All right. All right, guys. This was fun. The iconic tree of life may be changing near its root. A recent discovery could force the topmost domains of all life, bacteria, archaea, eukarya, to reduce down to just two domains, maybe. Which domains survive intact? And what did they know? What did they discover? This is from the journal Cell. The name of the study is Microtubules in Asgard Archaea. Settle in, people. And there will be a quiz. Pay attention. I've been especially interested in this iconic tree of life and microorganisms ever since I read Stephen Jay Gould's book, Full House, The Spread of Excellence from Plato to Darwin. Wonderful book, especially when narrated by Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. What a wonderful voice that guy has.
No spoilers, please.
Yeah. So he described there, and initially he starts with, he describes the old five kingdom classification of life. Remember this, guys?
Oh, yeah.
Plants,
I learned
animals,
that when I was like
fungi,
yeah, 10 years
or fungi,
old.
Fungi, protists, and monera. I remember those guys. Now, the plants, animals, and fungi, we know those. Protista, protists are a group of all the eukaryotes that are not fungi, animals, or plants. So protozoans, slime molds, stuff like that. Then monera is kind of a weird, I haven't heard that word in a while, but monera was like a catch-all category that grouped single-celled organisms, bacteria and archaea together, prokaryotic cells. So that's what that was. So many of us grew up with those classifications, and yes, we are slowly dying off. So they were the top dogs, right? All life on Earth fit under one of those five kingdoms. Maybe not beautifully, neatly, but they fit in there somewhere, to quote the Animatrix, and for a time, it was good. And then microbiology, oh, I just love that damn. All right, and then microbiology happened. This elucidated the hidden genetic relationships between organisms with unprecedented accuracy. And we learned that five kingdoms just didn't cut it anymore. They did not properly reflect Earth's evolutionary history and the diversity of life. Yep, just didn't cut it anymore.
Oh, they lied to
we
me,
needed,
basically.
Okay. Well, you know, like the Earth, you know, gets a little bit less round as we
That's
learn
right.
more about it.
That's right.
But we needed a broader classification, okay? So then Gould then described in his book how that forced the removal of the five kingdoms at the top, and they needed to be replaced with the three domains. These domains were bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Bacteria, we all know bacteria, right? They're our buddies. Bacteria, single-celled organisms that have prokaryotic cells and that have no nuclei. It's one of the main differentiators between these cells and other cells. Prokaryotic cells, bacteria. Then there was archaea. These have prokaryotic cells as well, but there's also major biochemical differences and other interesting differences between the bacterial prokaryotic cells. And the final domain, eukarya, that's us. And other things, and the rest. These organisms have eukaryotic cells that have a nucleus and other membraned organelles. Okay, animals, plants, fungi, protists are in here. That's four, think about that. That's four out of the five kingdoms that I just mentioned a minute ago in this one domain. Four out of the five are like put in there because they belong in there. All multicellular life is in there. Protists, of course, are single-celled. But all the rest are basically multicellular. So we have three domains to rule them all. And for a time, it was good. Now, has anyone ever fused Lord of the Rings and The Matrix before? I don't remember ever hearing that, but I doubt I'm the first. Okay, and for a time, it was good. So what's new now? All right, what's changed, right? I'm obviously going to talk about some change here. So researchers have been studying a recently found subgroup of archaea with probably the best name ever. They are called Asgard archaea.
Mm.
I just loved it.
Here we go. Marvel.
The nanosecond I heard Asgard archaea, I loved it. So that was basically, one website described it as a superphylum of archaea. Now, they use that name, as you know, from Norse mythology because they found it near a formation in a mid-Atlantic ridge called Loki's Castle. So, of course, you see the connection between Loki and Asgard. But when I first read Asgard archaea, I didn't think about Norse mythology. My first thought was the cool aliens from Stargate, the Asgard. I don't suppose any of you also thought of Stargate first. Kara, did you think of Stargate first when I said
No.
Asgard archaea? Probably not. Mm-mm. But yeah, I'm weird that way. So let's see. So yeah, they were cool aliens, but so tragic. All right. The new bit here for this news item has to do with the cytoskeleton. Did you guys know that cells have a skeleton, essentially?
No.
Sort of.
Yes.
No, I did not.
Yeah. Cytoskeleton, that's the framework of proteins in a cell that give it shape and support, and it enables even movement. All three domains have cytoskeletons in their cells, but in bacteria and archaea, they are simple structures. Eukarya cells, on the other hand, have very complex cytoskeletons, including very specialized structures called microtubules, And these things help the cells organize internally. They help with division, with cell division. And they also help moving materials around inside the cell, kind of like a cellular conveyor belt. Or, oh wait, also a better analogy would be those bank drive-through vacuum tube thingies. Maybe that's a better analogy. What do you even call those stupid things?
Pneumatic tubes.
I'll move on. Yes, pneumatic tubes. So these complex structures weren't supposed to exist in simpler organisms, just the eukaryotic cells, until they actually do, though. When they studied some of these Asgard archaea, they found not only a more complex cytoskeleton in general, but they also found microtubules as well. Now, they weren't quite as complex as eukaryotic cells, but these archaean cells had microtubules that shouldn't have been there. They should not have been in there. They've never been found in there before. And even in other archaean cells, they never saw microtubules before. Now, the researchers' takeaway is that there appears to be less of a distinction between archaea and eukarya, which then, of course, suggests that perhaps the eukaryotic cytoskeleton evolved directly from archaea ancestors. You got that? So you don't have these three domains branching out separately, but you have, well, I'll continue. We'll get to that point. So if this is correct, then eukaryotes evolved from within archaea and not separately from it. That's what I was trying to say. The tree then doesn't branch cleanly into three domains anymore. If this is true, that clean branching isn't valid anymore. Instead, it looks like there's just two major branches, bacteria and archaea, with eukarya kind of like nested inside of archaea, maybe as some like super phylum. I'm not sure, but it no longer would have its own domain. So the next question is the cytoskeleton critical for the evolution of complex life? That's one of the big questions that they're going to be working on. Perhaps it is. The researchers think that a complex cytoskeleton was clearly important for the evolution of eukaryotes. And get this. This was really cool. Some Asgards have tentacle-like appendages that are moved by the cytoskeleton, right? So that might help them actually grab or interact with their environment in complex ways. Professor Martin Pilhofer at ETH Zurich said, "This remarkable cytoskeleton was probably at the beginning of this development. It could have enabled Asgard archaea to form appendages, thereby allowing them to interact with and then seize and engulf a bacterium." Now, what bacterium do you think he was referring to? He was referring to a bacterium being absorbed into the cell and becoming mitochondria. This is basically the beginning. I mean, mitochondria, you know, it's like taking a kind of a crappy car and throwing in like a jet engine. That's why, you know, complex cell life took off. I mean, the mitochondria, these amazing powerhouses. I mean, basically evolution on Earth changed when that happened. So, all right. So who knows what they're going to find, but that this cytoskeleton, the fact that these cells have this complex cytoskeleton could have meant that this complexity existed far earlier than we thought. So in the meantime, though, until this happens, I think we should prepare for the possibility that we'll have only two high level domains. So what do you guys think that they're going to do with this, with the domain names?
They better not be a bunch of series of numbers and letters. That's for sure.
Yeah. Right, Jay? 4.357. So what I think they're going to do is, I think they're just going to be boring, and it's going to be like, okay, it's the two top level domains now are bacteria and archaea, because eukarya will just be kind of underneath archaea, and that'll be probably what they're going to do, right? Because that makes sense. But I think they should
fuse. It does make sense.
But I think they should fuse the archaea designation with the eukarya and call it archaea. But they'll never do that because that's way, way too interesting. So either way, stay tuned for a potentially interesting minor tweak to our family tree, and who knows when that's going to happen. But it could, you know, if this pans out, you know, the two domains could go from three to two, you know, in a few years. Who knows if it's really going to happen? But this looks pretty solid with this study that I read. So we'll see what happens.
And it's weird to think that we are archaea, basically.
Yeah, but yeah, weird. I'd rather be from archaea though than bacteria.
Really?
Because archaea, oh yeah, I mean
they're cooler.
Steve,
you think
about it. Archaea have most of the extremophiles. I mean, a lot of archaea are extremophiles. Archaea, yeah, I think they're definitely the OG. They are so metabolically diverse. So many of them are or extremophiles that could survive crazy, crazy crap, that I'd rather be descended from archaea than a bacteria. I'll just like.
But didn't
just
we used to call
that.
Them archaebacteria?
Yeah, we used to think that they were basically, like I said earlier, they were Monera,
they
right?
Look like, yeah.
Bacteria and archaea. They were single celled. They were prokaryotic. They're so close. They've got to be basically the same thing. But once, you know, microbiology took off and they're like, holy crap, look at the biochemistry of this damn single cell. They deserve their own domain. They're not going anywhere.
All right. Thanks, Bob. All right, Evan, tell us about Crow's mad math skills.
Yes, I am going to do that. To prepare for this particular news item, here's what I plugged into ChatGPT. What was the monkey versus birds debate about on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast? You want to hear the answer when it came
up? Yeah, do it.
How great is this? The monkey versus birds debate on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast was a humorous, long-running discussion among the show's hosts, particularly involving Perry DeAngelis, who staunchly defended monkeys as superior to birds. This lighthearted rivalry became a recurring theme on the podcast. In episode 53, Perry recounted a news story about a man caught smuggling animals through customs. When confronted, the man admitted, "I have monkeys in my pants." The incident involved two loris monkeys surviving a transcontinental flight concealed in the man's underwear, while birds of paradise he was also smuggling perished during the journey. Perry used this story to argue that monkeys are tougher and more resilient than birds, humorously stating that surviving such condition proved monkeys' superiority. The debate continued in subsequent episodes, with listeners contributing their own arguments and anecdotes. For example, in episode 64, a listener corrected a previous misclassification of a loris, noting that it is a prosimian, not a monkey, adding a layer of scientific accuracy to the ongoing jest. This playful banter became a beloved inside joke among fans of the podcast, showcasing the host's camaraderie and the show's blend of science with humor. That's what you get when you plug that in.
What the hell?
Isn't that cool that it like can pick out that little aspect, basically?
It's incredibly accurate.
So that is accurate.
From transcripts?
That was it. That's what it got, Bob. That's exactly – I didn't have to go through iterations. Just one question, and that's what it poured out. And it's surprisingly accurate.
Wow, that's cool.
So let's continue the debate, shall we? Because a recent study published in Science Advances reveals that carrion crows possess the ability to recognize geometric shapes, a cognitive skill previously attributed primarily to humans. Researchers tested how these crows perceive visual shapes, particularly quadrilaterals, such as squares, rectangles, and parallelograms, using methodologies similar to those employed in studies with humans and monkeys. The birds' work involved basically playing computer games that are designed to tease out how much they know about math. And for this study, the birds would look at a computer screen, and they would see a group of six shapes. They would be rewarded with a tasty mealworm, yum, if they can peck on the one shape that was different from the five others. This study was performed at the University of Tübingen, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, in Germany. And Andreas Nieder, who is a cognitive neurobiologist, was the lead researcher for this particular project. He said, initially, we presented some very obvious different figures. For instance, five moons and one flower. So the crow would peck on the flower shape and they got a snack. But after the birds understood the game, got used to it, the researchers started showing them sets of shapes that included squares and parallelograms or irregular quadrilaterals. And the crows, for example, could see five perfect squares along with one four-sided figure that was just slightly off. And the researchers wanted to know whether or not with these quadrilaterals, they could still continue to find the outlier, even though the outlier was looking perceptually similar to the other five shapes. The findings suggest that crows can spontaneously discern key geometric properties such as length, parallelism, perpendicularity, and symmetry, indicating an advanced level of visual processing.
Wow.
And then it even goes further because a similar test has been done with primates. Baboons, apparently in a recent study, did this as well. They could not achieve the same results that the crows achieved.
Wow.
Yep. So where does it come from and why crows? That's a good question. And that's going to be the next sort of the next phase. They're going to start to go into that level of research as to figure out why this happens with crows in specifically. There really hasn't been a lot of work on this aspect of mathematics for species other than humans. So there's not really much to compare it to. But definitely it suggests that they have the capacity to understand geometric irregularities, and that capacity is not unique to humans. Definitely challenging notions that cognitive abilities are solely a product of human culture and education. Nope. Understanding how crows and other animals perceive and interpret geometric information could provide deeper insights into the evolution of visual and cognitive processing in the animal kingdom. Do you find those results surprising, Steve?
Not at all. I believe this is a much delayed point in my column on the bird versus monkey debate. what it brings up, though, is something that we've known for a while, but this is like more evidence of that, is that, first of all, crows are as evolved as humans, as chimpanzees, right, as primates. Every creature alive today has as long an evolutionary history behind it as every other creature alive today. But also, it's kind of hard to answer the question, like, which animal is quote-unquote smarter? Like, they evolved a different intelligence than primates did, right? Than mammals did, and specifically primates. Primates evolved a different intelligence than, say, dolphins.
Well, and even primates' intelligence, like, are humans smarter than apes? Maybe, yes, but if you drop me off in an ape habitat right now without tools, I don't think I would fare very well.
Right.
Yeah. I think I evolved. I didn't adapt to that habitat.
Certainly humans have some extreme intellectual capabilities not shared by other animals. But it makes perfect sense that, you know, like corvids, you know, the group that contains crows, do have a lot of cognitive ability. And it doesn't surprise me at all that there are some things that they could do better than primates. I don't find that surprising.
Haven't they been shown also to have tool-using capabilities?
Yep.
So, yeah, there is definitely, we have to reanalyze the whole monkey versus bird. I know that's not entirely accurate, but that's what we're calling it, the monkey versus bird debate. And you're right. We continue to see more studies add up into the bird column on things. And, as primates ourselves, we have a certain bias, perhaps, but time to shed those biases.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week, I played this noisy. So a big clue in there was that noise in the background.
Like the clattering, the clicking?
Yeah, that repetitive noise.
I'm assuming that's the recording device.
That is correct, Steve.
Uh-huh.
Which implies that it's very primitive.
Also correct. Wow, it's like you're a trained skeptic.
Is it a wax cylinder?
So let's get into it. Oh. Listener named Andy Roche said it sounds a little like some dialogue out of Half-Life 2 with a motor from one of the game's vehicles running in the background. It sounds like the name Gordon is mentioned. Gordon Freeman, perhaps? Well, I am a huge fan of Half-Life 2. So is Steve. And I'm ashamed to tell you that that is not from Half-Life, but that was a cool reference you brought to us. Thank you. Cindy Kane Shiro wrote in and said, this is the first time that I've ever made a guess. Is this a recording of L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of the cult Scientology? It sounds similar to his nonsense. And I have to apologize to you, Cindy, because I didn't make it crystal clear what I was looking for in this noisy. I wasn't looking for who said it, but I've done this before where I have played, people talking.
So you know that that's not L. Ron Hubbard because the guy's not drunk.
That's true, Steve. Good point.
There you go.
So anyway, but thanks for writing in. It was my bad. I should have made it more clear. So next time, I promise you it won't happen again. So I'm going to jump right to the winner because we had so many people guess correctly because apparently this was taken from a popular YouTube channel. So Howard Bletcher said, first time guesser, a couple weeks ago, I watched a YouTube vid of someone testing with the intent to repair a recorder that uses stainless wire. I've never seen or heard of such a device. That's what this sounds like to me. And then he says a YouTuber said something about these recordings being used mainly by psychiatrists. So this is actually correct. Let me give you more details on what this is. This Noisy is playback from something called a wire recorder. And a wire recorder machine uses a reel-to-reel system. You know, if you've ever seen like an old film projector, right? It rolls off one reel and collects on the other reel. The wire is made of steel. It's very thin. It looked to me about the thickness of a human hair. And the sound information is stored on the wire magnetically. So as the wire is moving past the write and playhead, it's encoding it magnetically, and then it's as it plays back, they're able to translate that back into sound. The machine was originally developed in the late 1800s, and they were widely used from the 1930s to the 1950s. I'm very surprised that I had never heard this before. And then somebody else wrote in and gave even more information. So this recording is from the 1940s. It's played on a Pierce Wire recorder model 55B by Paul Carlson of the YouTube channel Mr. Carlson's Lab. And I did watch some of that, and it was very cool, very technical, but a lot of fun to watch. So that is a wire recorder. I'll play a little bit for you. Listen in the background for the noise of the machine. Not bad quality for what they were using as a medium.
Yeah, it's totally understandable.
Yep. I have a new Noisy for you guys. This was sent in by a listener named Vladimir Bjorn Asgeirsson. I got that name damn close, I promise you. And here it is. Pretty strange and eerie sounding. If you think you know what this week's Noisy is, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And don't forget, if you heard something cool this week, you can also send that to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, quick announcements here.
Yeah.
You could give our show a rating on whatever podcast player you're using, or you can use iTunes to give us a rating. It helps new people find the show. We have a huge conference coming up in less than a month as you hear this. It's called Nauticon 2025. We have a Beatles theme this year for the conference. We will be having lots of different things going on, like a live Boomer versus Zoomer, which is a game that we came up with live contestants. It's a ton of fun. We will also be doing a live sing-along hosted by George Robb. Last year, the theme was the 80s. This year, of course, it's going to be the Beatles. It's going to be a ton of fun. If you want to socialize, if you want to have a good time, if you want to meet new people and make some friends, then go to notaconcon.com for more information. Tickets are still available.
And Jay, we should mention that we have new events available for Nauticon because we sold out, on a lot of the special stuff, the VIP and the board game. We have a lot of people asking for stuff. We added two separate ticketed events, 1 hour private SGU recordings on Friday over the lunch period and Saturday over the lunch period. These are separate 1 hour ticketed events. So check that out. Those are now active on the website.
Guys, we are coming to Kansas in September of this year. This is happening in mid-September. You can go to theskepticsguide.org, and on the homepage, we have buttons there for the extravaganza that we'll be doing in Kansas, and also for an SGU private show, which we will also be doing in Kansas. We should be, I think, about 40 minutes outside of Kansas City in a town called Lawrence, which I hear is a really, really fun town. It's a college town. So if you're interested, please join us. Go check out our website.
Thank you, Jay. A couple emails. Let's see if we can get to both of them. The first one comes from Nathan, who writes, "Been a fan of the show for a number of years and now have enjoyed learning and engaging in the community and the ideas discussed each week. I was hoping to ask your opinions on how skepticism can inform the way we view certain industries and institutions when individuals can cause conflict within core ideologies. The example I'm thinking of is how to view Tesla in the current political landscape. For background, I'm in the market for a new car to replace one that's recently hit end of life, and I was hoping to get something electric. This is driven both by the impressive technology and the reduced emissions and costs, especially attractive in my state where our power is almost entirely hydro. The Tesla Model 3 is in my price range and is by all accounts a fantastic car with sound engineering behind it. I come unstuck through grappling with what I believe is a logical environmental financial choice. The crinkle, though, is the ties to Musk, who I would have picked as my skeptical jackass of the year. This goes back to my original subject matter of whether we can separate art from the artist in the technological and political landscapes. For consideration, how much of current Tesla is driven by Elon, and how much does that matter if the product at the end is still efficient, safe, reliable, and just well designed? How should we as skeptics or individuals be tackling these decisions, and should this weigh in strongly to the final decision? Interested in your thoughts. So what do you guys think? Is it reasonable to boycott Tesla? I think we could say categorically, right, that any kind of violence or vandalism is not justified and shouldn't be done, and we condemn that, right? But
of course.
Yeah. But because just in case there's any confusion about that. But certainly your purchasing decision is a type of political speech.
100%.
And absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
and not just monetarily. I mean, it is monetarily because you're monetarily supporting something. But it's also, you have to accept the fact that if you drive around in this car, you are making a statement.
Yeah, I mean, I think partly, but the problem there is a lot of people like me bought their Teslas years ago. You know,
that's why they put the stickers on the back.
I know you have to have the sticker. That's kind of silly.
Disclaimer sticker.
So this is my personal take on it. So first of all, yeah. I get the notion of separating the art from the artist, and you have to do that to some degree. I don't care about the political opinions or whatever. I mean,
Driving a Volkswagen, everyone driving an Audi. What are you going to do? Say this was Hitler's idea or something? I mean, come on, you got to separate.
Or even just like you have an actor or a musician or whatever who has questionable behavior or beliefs or whatever, you can get lost in the weeds there.
Yeah, but don't say
it becomes silly at some point, in my opinion. But
sure, but that line is different for everybody.
I agree.
And just
agree.
Because it can become silly, like
I agree.
What I said
to him is like, I don't think the separating art from the artist applies here. And again, you can choose to do that, but it's a choice. And
also, this isn't just art. It's a consumable.
I know this is a consumer good. This is a big purchase. Yeah. Not just like buying a loaf of bread. This is a $35,000, even more. Purchase. It's big, and it is absolutely speech, you know, and it can mm-hmm. It is one of the few levers we have to affect the world, you know, at the mm-hmm. current time. And so what I wrote back to him was, I don't think that you can hide behind the notion of separating art from the artist here, because you are making a statement. You are making a political decision. Unfortunately, we didn't do that. He did it. He tied his brand and his empire to a very, in my opinion, extreme political position. And that made purchasing his car political. He did that.
And it's not just what it represents either. It's also, he is actively benefiting financially.
Yeah, hugely.
Deeply from his relationship to our government.
No shame, but you'd have to make whatever decision you think is best for you, with your eyes open. I just wouldn't hide behind this notion of, well, you separate the art from the artist. Like, well, you choose to do that when you think it's not that important, but you can't really, I think, in this case. You are making a decision. And you may still decide to get the Tesla because you think that the benefits outweigh the downside politically, whatever. That's a personal choice you are making. Don't hide from it. I said, for me personally, I don't know that I could do it. I'm in the market for an EV right now. And I love my Tesla that we bought, whatever it was, 5-6 years ago. But I would have a hard time doing it now because it's just given what he has done. And what he represents.
Would not do it.
But it's a personal decision. I get that. The good news is, though, there's lots of other options out there. There's lots of very good EVs out there. So it's not it's the only game in town.
Or China's got a good one.
Or even just South Korea. I mean, the Kia Electric is very good. There's other choices. So you're not, 6 years ago or longer, it was tougher. The Tesla really did stand out, you know, in the industry significantly, especially because of the recharging infrastructure. But now it's not as true anymore. especially since, you know, they're essentially allowing other companies to use the Tesla chargers with adapters, you know. So it makes it more, I think, feasible to have another EV. It's an interesting question. It's a horrible question, you know, decision, dilemma that is being foisted upon us. But I don't think we could hide from it, is the bottom line.
I mean, Steve, I agree. It's one of those things. I mean, this is so unbelievably politically charged. I mean, if you are a conservative and, you know, you're reading the different news and have a different perception on everything, then it's a no-brainer. I mean, the a lot of the Tesla vehicles, you know, reading reviews on them other than the Cybertruck, they're good cars.
They're great cars. It just sucks that they're so great. I honestly just wish that the board of Tesla would just fire him as CEO. Right now he's a drag on the company.
Now, personally, I wouldn't get one, largely because I would be afraid that it would get vandalized.
Yeah, but that shouldn't be the reason. I think it's so unfortunate, because there's a legitimate ban protest that you can do here. And because a small, tiny, small subset of people are choosing to do vandalism and violence, it taints politically the whole thing, or at least it becomes a convenient talking point.
Yeah, dismissively
on the other side. Not legitimate,
there's always been violence. There's always been vandalism.
There's always going to be the fringe. Yeah, I know. But it just sucks. Yeah. And I just wish people would realize.
It does. I agree. But like we can't let that talking point take over the narrative.
I agree. We have to point it out. Most people are protesting peacefully, and then there's a couple of vandals who come out at night. That's what's happening. But they try to make it seem like that's the whole thing. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that was massively the rhetoric during all the Black Lives Matter protests when people were like, it's terrorism and these people are rioting in the streets. Like, oh my God.
It's all propaganda.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's go on to the next one really quick. This one is about the moon rotating. And this is another like kind of crank email. I had a number of backs and forths with this person. I'll just read you his initial email.
Oh, is he a flat mooner?
No, it's weird. It's so weird. I just couldn't wrap my head around what his problem was. So he says the moon does not rotate on its axis, which is kind of a weird belief to hold on to.
Okay.
He said rotation in orbit. An object moving in a 360-degree orbit will, by the end of that orbit, have returned to its original position relative to the body it's orbiting. In that sense, its overall orientation has rotated 360 degrees relative to an external viewpoint. Rotation on its axis. This requires a change in which part of the object leads its motion. A tightly locked body, by definition, maintains the same face forward the object it orbits. Therefore, the same part of the object consistently leads its motion in that relationship. The one-to-one orbital period to rotational period of tightly locked moons, like our moon and 20-plus others, is a consequence of their orbit and the gravitational forces involved. It results in a consistent face towards the primary body. According to the definition of rotation on its axis, this consistent facing means that these tightly locked moons are not rotating on their axis in the sense that different parts of them are taking the lead in their motion. The rotation that completes one cycle per orbit is a rotation of their orientation in space due to their orbital movement, not a spin around an internal axis that changes which part leads the way. He had a lot of other sort of things. He has this teddy bear experiment where you hold the teddy bear in front of you and you spin around and the teddy bear is always facing you. Therefore, it's not rotating. So I tried to figure out, all right, obviously this is ridiculous, right? I mean, the moon rotates on its axis, but it's always interesting to try to deconstruct it and figure out where's his major malfunction? What mental mistake is he making?
And he's holding a teddy bear and he turns around in a big circle and the teddy bear's not rotating. Yes, it is rotating.
Of course it is. So but that's like his big experiment. It's like the teddy bear hypothesis. Like he really focuses on it. So
you put a laser on the teddy bear's forehead and you'll paint a circle around the room.
But that is an external thing that doesn't count, apparently. Right? I said, yeah, what about the moon in relation to the sun? It clearly is rotating. Well, he said, that doesn't matter. It only matters because it's local to the Earth. So clearly, the problem here is one of frame of reference, right? Yeah. He is choosing a rather bizarre frame of reference in order to make his point. And in fact, he's choosing a non-inertial frame, which is always a bad frame of reference to choose. If you choose an inertial frame, meaning one where there's no other local movement, you know what I mean?
Like if you're a point in space.
Yeah, right, exactly, like a point in space. Or, you know, for our solar system, you could use the sun. That's a good sort of non-inertial frame within the context of our solar system. And it's absolutely rotating. Now, of course, there's an objective way, according to physics, to tell. How did we figure out, or what's one of the ways in which we prove the Earth is rotating on its axis?
Foucault's pendulum.
Yeah, the pendulum, it rotates once every 24 hours as the Earth spins. So you could do that on the moon. I don't think we've ever done it. But,
oh, interesting. Let's do that.
But we could take a month, you know, 28 days, you know, yeah, for it to go around.
It's too long.
I don't think anyone's constructed such a pendulum on the moon, but that would be interesting to do that. But the question is, would it rotate around? And the answer is definitely yes, it would. And so by definition, objectively, it is rotating, and you can't just choose some bizarre frame of reference to argue that it isn't. But he's just so mentally locked into this, I couldn't break him out of it. Anyway, very interesting.
He was staring into the teddy bear eyes too much, as he spins around.
But the teddy bear is not moving.
But the teddy bear.
But again, he just thinks that, like, everyone else is wrong. Again, it always comes down to, too, like the people who are acting like cranks, is there's always that element of I'm right and everyone else is wrong.
Mm.
You know, there's a little bit of hubris involved.
Yeah, it is a flat lunar.
And what you should be doing
mentality.
Is he should be trying to figure out why am I wrong?
Break it. Right, break it.
Not let me convince you that I'm right, that I've sort of reinvented physics or I've figured this thing out that hundreds of years of astronomers haven't figured out, but explain to me why I'm wrong. What mental error am I making? That's the approach. I always assume that's what they're asking anyway, and then that's how I answer it. Yeah. Let me explain
to you. There's no shame in asking people to help you with that, you know, especially people who have a more robust understanding of these kinds of things.
Well, and that's also fundamental to the scientific process. I think a thing. How do I break it?
Right, the guys who figured, who discovered that faster than light neutrinos. You know, they were like, guys, what mistake are we making? What tell us how we're wrong?
Right, you have to assume you're wrong.
See that plug over there?
Yeah, that cable over there. I think you should double
check.
That's
a healthy way of approaching it.
Yeah, I know. I end up spending a lot of time on like my response TikTok videos. Like built into every one is like, you know, this could be solved with just a tiny little itty bitty bit of humility on your part would fix this issue that you're having of thinking that you figured something out that the world got wrong. All right. Anyway, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Except this week, I have facts and there are four of them.
Mm.
Now, these all have the theme. The theme is extinct genomes.
Uh-oh.
Okay. And the preface to all of them are, we have fully sequenced nuclear genomes from the following extinct animals. Right? So I'm going to list you four animals. Three of which we have sequenced the nuclear genomes for, and one we do not. You have to tell me which one is not true.
Okay.
Got it?
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Item number one, the dodo, famous extinct bird of the Mauritius Island. Two, the blue buck, a blue antelope, and the first large African mammal to go extinct in modern times. Item number three, the giant moa, both North Island and South Island Dinornis species of New Zealand. And item number four, Denisovans, a close relative of humans and Neanderthals. Evan, to celebrate tax season being over, you get to go first.
This is crazy, Steve. I've heard of dodos. I've heard of the giant moa. I have definitely heard of Denisovans. A blue buck? I've never heard of that. So I'm kind of biased in my own head, like thinking, okay, well, didn't hear a blue buck, so maybe that's the one that's the fiction. At the same time, my gosh, the genome sequence for the Denisovans, that seems whoa, really, the whole thing that seems extreme. Like, wouldn't that be difficult? Isn't that enormous? So I'm having multiple issues here with this. It ultimately just comes down to a guess, though. why? Which one? Why? You know, I want to say Denisovans as the fiction because I think that would seem to be the obvious one of these four. But then I, you know, come back to kind of the game itself and it's like, okay, that's the one you definitely want me to pick. And then my mind goes back to Blue Buck because I've never heard of the Blue Buck, a blue antelope. That's made up. That's something out of Willy Wonka or something. So I don't know. I'll say the giant moa for no particular reason, Steve. It is strictly a guess. This is really puzzling me.
Okay. Bob?
I think maybe the Denisovans are meant to be like, ooh, no, can't be that. But they didn't go extinct that long ago. Something about the moa, I think that I don't know when they went extinct, but I think it was quite, you know, longer than you would think. So I mean,
those
I'm not
huge.
Yeah, I'm not.
You've seen pictures of those, right? The drawings.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm not sure about any of these, but I'm going to go with the moa.
Okay, Kara.
I just don't agree with the guys. I don't think.
I barely agree with myself.
Well, you probably can't tell us this late, but the Denisovans went extinct like tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago. These other things went extinct like a few hundred years ago, right? Like
I thought the moas were.
This is something that Kara, I think, has to handle on her own.
Yeah, maybe, okay. But like I think that these things did not go extinct. They were modern. They were contemporary. I know Denisovans were also contemporaneous with modern humans, but we're talking ancient modern humans. I think that these things were around during like big civilizations. So it just feels like we probably have museum specimens of these other three organisms that we could extract whole DNA from, whereas the Denisovan DNA is going to be from like fossils. And that's why it just seems less likely. Granted, there's probably more of a push, like because humans are egocentric and we would love to have a full sequence of a hominid species. But I think that's way more work. And so maybe we did it and maybe we just haven't gotten around to one of the other ones. But in terms of what's most feasible, I think the Denisovans would be the least feasible to sequence. So I've got to say that's the fiction.
I happen to agree with you.
And Jay.
Yeah,
I agree with Kara. I mean, I think of all of these, you know, I've never heard of the blue buck before either. I mean, I would think because I've heard the term Denisovans before, and I have a very, very vague feeling about how old it is. And I think they existed a long time ago. So I'm just going to go with Kara on that.
Good. So we have a nice even split.
Yeah.
So let's start with the first one, the dodo, since you guys all agree upon this. The dodo, famous extinct bird of the Mauritius Island. Do we have the fully sequenced nuclear genome of this creature? So just for some details, why do I say qualified as nuclear genome? That's obviously like the DNA in the nucleus of the cell, as opposed to, what's the other option?
Mitochondrial DNA.
But
with mitochondrial DNA, you wouldn't be able to reconstruct an organism.
No, but it's really good for figuring out branch evolutionary relationships.
Yeah, so. It's great for evolution. It's great for forensics. It's great for all those things, like understanding.
So that's why sometimes we do that. Sometimes like there are lots of creatures where we've sequenced the mitochondrial DNA specifically so that we could tell its evolutionary relationships. It's also, you could tell a lot about its how much genetic diversity there is in the population, for example. So it's very useful, but not for
nuclear DNA. We're talking about like de-extinction. Yeah. We're talking about like we need a fully sequenced genome to be able to make this thing again.
All right. So this one, the dodo, is science. We have completely sequenced
it.
Now I say fully sequenced. That means some creatures we have, for example, we have a partial like genome of a lot of creatures, but it has to get to a certain, you know, saying like fully sequenced doesn't mean that we know 100% about it. It just means that they have the whole genome, but there still may be some, it's like the question is how many errors are there? It doesn't mean error free. Let me just put it that way. Saying that we have fully sequenced the genome doesn't mean that it's highly detailed and error free. So there's different quality. Different resolution, but you still count as being fully sequenced if you basically have the full genome. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. But this was that same company who did the Direwolf, right?
That's it. This is the same company. Yeah. This is the Colossal they Biosciences. That, they yeah. did that. Yeah. All right. You guys also agree on the blue buck, a blue antelope, and the first large African mammal to go extinct in modern times. You
Never
guys
heard of it.
All think this one is science. And this one is
fiction.
Science. This is also science.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah, I've known about the blue buck for a long time, just because I'm interested in extinct large mammal fauna and stuff like that. And it's some of the artists' drawings of it, and also we have some skins I think still intact from it. Beautiful, beautiful antelope. These gorgeous curved horns, this blue tinted coat, kind of a large antelope. And it was hunted for its fur, for its coat, to extinction about 200 years ago. Yeah, so it's been extinct for about 200 years.
Do they have any of the coats?
We have.
Do they have any of the coats left?
Yeah, that's the thing we do. So that's where we got the DNA from.
Well, at least we got the coats.
Did it maintain its blueness over all that time?
So we have. They got DNA from 25 different fossils. And so that was, improves the ability to get sequencing. Although there was one that was really high quality, that is most of the sequencing was done from this one well-preserved genome. So we got lucky with this one fossil. Without that one, we wouldn't have been able to do it, basically, from what I understand. So, so that's nice. So that's absolutely, I think, should be on the short list for de-extinction if we're going to do that. Because, first of all, it's not a predator or anything. It's an antelope. Its ecosystem is there. We can just reintroduce it. Just another antelope, and it's gorgeous. So, and it went extinct because of people, right? So that's kind of my criteria for why you should be on the short list. So dodo, blue buck, definitely should bring them back. Okay, I guess we'll keep going in order. The giant moa, both North Island and South Island Dinornis species of New Zealand. Evan, you kind of were bouncing back and forth between blue buck and Denisovans, and you just suddenly jumped over to the giant moa.
Yes.
For no reason.
right.
We saw some giant moa skeletons when we were in New Zealand. It went extinct relatively rapidly between 1380 and 1440, so it has to be at least about 500, 600 years old.
Okay, it's not that long.
Oh, I thought they were a lot older. Okay.
Yeah. No. 5 to 600 years old. So this one, and it's so... Evan and
Jay.
And
Kara. It was Evan and Kara.
Anyone but Bob.
No. Yeah, Evan and Bob. Didn't Bob? Didn't you say
Bob.
The name?
Yes, he's pulling your leg.
I'm fucking with you.
Yeah, so Evan and Bob said the giant moa. And again, for this to be true, we need to have both species in the genus Dinornis, both the North Island giant moa and the South Island.
That's right. Double your chance here.
And this one is... the fiction.
Whoa!
We did not.
High five. Total guess. Yeah!
I knew it, dude. I didn't doubt it for a second.
We do not have the complete genome of either of them, of either the North Island or the South Island. Now, we do have the complete genome of the little bush moa, which is a different genus, Anomalopteryx.
Doesn't count.
It doesn't count. That's why I threw in the genus just to be 100% because there is another moa that we do have the genome for. But it's a different genus. Anomalopteryx didiformis.
Anomalopteryx?
Yeah.
It's the anomalous?
Anomaly.
It's
anomaly.
The little bush moa. Apparently it was about the size of a turkey. So not the big boys, like the...
not the 12-footers,
the Dinornis,
right.
Yeah. But we do have the complete genome for that guy. But not the other two. So that is the fiction. So that means that we do have a complete sequenced nuclear genome of the Denisovans.
How?
We also have it for the Neanderthals. Now, the reason why I chose Denisovans over Neanderthals is because I thought everybody knew that we have completely sequenced the Neanderthal. And I thought you might think, but I don't know if they did the Denisovans, but we have. Yeah, and we had a fossil specimen that yielded up a DNA sample sufficient to do a high, pretty good resolution sequencing of the Denisovans. And we have been able to, as a result, do a pretty genome-wide comparison between Neanderthals, humans, and Denisovans. And that was how they were able to determine that the genetic diversity within the Denisovans lies outside of the range of the genetic diversity within the Neanderthals, and it is a different species by those criteria. So that's how we know that, because they were able to sequence the genome.
Wow.
Oh, cool, cool.
Yeah.
I mean, they went extinct, what, only like, what, 50,000 years ago? So
that's what I thought.
30,000?
Yeah, well, I think more.
But no, it's 30,000. I'm telling you, I'm not guessing. It's 30,000. I just looked it up.
So yeah, well, so did I.
Between 30 and 50,000 years.
Yeah, this story says around 50,000 years ago. You're right.
I'm seeing here on Wikipedia 25,000 years. Who? Well,
okay. Yeah, so there's right, a range. So then this one says 40,000.
Yeah, they're all over.
Yeah, so let's say 30 to 50,000 years ago is when they went extinct. We'll have to do a deeper dive to see like if there's more tighter consensus there. But yeah, around there. And again, I think the Neanderthal, we're talking like 35,000 is the number I have in my head for when they went extinct. It's around that same time.
Still seems kind of impressive.
That's
very impressive. That's like, yeah, they did a lot of work to do that.
Yeah, thousands of years is impressive.
And they must have had a lot of specimens.
Now, that doesn't mean that the DNA is of sufficient quality that you could use it to make a clone.
Right.
That takes really high quality DNA. And if it's too degraded, even if we could say we have a complete genome, quote unquote complete, there might be too many errors and whatever for it to function as for cloning purposes. But it could be used for the genetic engineering purposes, although I don't think anyone's going to do that. I mean, that's, you know, no one's going to make try to de-extinct Neanderthals or Denisovans or Homo erectus. Like that would be crazy unethical, I think.
No, you're nuts. How cool would that be?
I mean, come on. I have a hard time seeing like ethical approval for that. That doesn't mean
it won't happen.
It won't happen sometime in the future when the technology becomes, proliferates and everybody...
Right, press this button.
Yeah, really, basically. But I suspect there'll be laws against that sort of thing.
Laws are made to be... obeyed at all times.
Obeyed, yes, followed.
Yes, please, obey the laws.
And debated. All right, well, good job.
Evan
and Bob.
Yeah,
Scott. Got a little lucky.
Surprising.
Nice work, boys. Kara and I, we're not angry. We're not going to hold a grudge. We know you cheated.
Yeah, right.
We know you threw a dart at a dartboard for that one.
Evan's like, I don't know anything. Number two.
No. Saturn was rising in Taurus, so the luck of it was emanated down to me. So
Bob clearly. Literally tried to do a confused Steve at the last second.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, the old shell game kind of thing. Yeah. Where's the P? Okay, move it around. Was it here? Was it there?
Do the old Jedi mind trick on me.
Don't matter. Still got to win.
I have a little bit of sad news before I give the quote, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
We have to announce the passing of Wink Martindale.
Yeah, I saw that.
Wait a second.
He lived a long time, man.
Bob, I know you cite him more than anyone else on the SGU.
Yeah, I didn't know. Actually, I didn't even know he was still alive. So
yeah, I'll be honest with you. How old was he?
91.
91. Good for him.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Wink Martindale, just for context, is, and I think we've done this on the show a number of times, whenever someone asks you to guess a name, there's a few like just funny sounding names, like really non sequitur, whimsical sounding names that we throw out there.
Right. So, and Wink Joey Bag of Donuts.
Joey Bag of Donuts. Wink Martindale is one of them. This is one of our go-to fake guesses when people say,
right,
you're asking for a name. Because, yeah, Wink Martindale, I mean, it's a great name. It's just a great name.
It is.
It is so TV game show host.
I know, absolutely.
And he was 91?
91.
Wow. I can't believe it. I just Googled it because I saw a quote. Sorry, this is going to feel a little bit like a non sequitur, but I saw a quote from David Attenborough because he's doing a new show. And he said something like, in my nearly 100 years on this earth. And I was like, wait, what? And I just Googled it. And David Attenborough is 98.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Wow. Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
And still working regularly.
For their entire childhood, my daughters didn't know that Wink Martindale was a real person.
Yeah,
it's a novella thing, right?
It's true. It's because, like, I guess he was in his prime so long ago.
Yeah,
like we don't hear 70s, about him now. Yeah.
It's definitely a 70s throwback thing. Yeah. So, our love and respect for the entire Martindale family. Mm-hmm. All right, the quote this week: the ease with which we believe things that flatter us or confirm our prejudices should always be suspect. The wise words of Christopher Hitchens.
Mm-hmm.
Yo, yep. Man. Yeah.
Very pithy. Love it.
Definitely. Yep. Oh, yeah. Always pithy and little gems from him.
Yeah.
Are wonderful.
Be most suspicious of beliefs that either flatter you or confirm your, what you want to believe. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes. Enjoy 100%. Them for a few moments, but then.
That's right. Enjoy the dopamine release, but then get to work.
You know, because we all know people who like just jump on anything that supports what they want to believe. Like, that's it. God. That's an ironclad fact. You know?
Yeah. It's in their, if it's in their worldview, yeah, we know some people like, oh, yeah. Hook, line, and sinker.
But everyone does it to some degree, but there are people at one end of the spectrum. Your goal should be to be at the other end of the spectrum, to be. Like, I don't want to say something, especially if it, like, is right in my sweet spot and supports something I want to be true. You know, it's like, I better, before I start throwing this out there, I better carefully vet this.
Right. Especially if you're going to throw it out there.
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. You know, you hate to, like, include things in your list of facts that you think you know that are not true, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But good life lesson and very, very pithily put by Christopher
Hitchens. I hate when I find... The opposite, when I find something that I've been saying, telling people, like a cool fact, and then I found out that it's bullshit. I'm like, oh my God, who did I tell the past 20 years this awesome fact? I got to like find them and tell them, hey, wait a second, that was wrong.
That's like you have herpes and like, who did I have sex with in the last?
Oh my gosh.
No, you don't need to make that connection. Jesus.
Just reminded me of that, you know. You need to like reconstruct all of your connections. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
Thanks. You got it, brother.
Before we sign off, the SGU would like to thank the following patrons for their generous support of the SGU. Parrish, Lee, Casey, Justin, Howard, Jonathan, Silly Tuna, Frizzo, Mary, Jake, David, Michael, Kevin, Steve, Jeffrey, Suzanne, Diane, Ben, Tina, Sionitis, Strong, AP, David, Jim, Dan, Douglas, Albert, Simon, Eli, Whitney, Wesley, Eric, Adrian, Wayne, Heather, Franklin, Gosplan, Joe, Steve, Marcel, Joe, Truth, Morgan, Jason, George, Jeremy, Ken, DJ, Stefan, Wolf, Olivia, Kevin, Oak, Werner, Jeff, Charlie, Tyler, and Mark. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.